just for the record, we've both fished the Smokies for natural fish. Those natural fish, for the most part, are much smaller than the stock fish, but and they're a real treat. I love them. And I know you got it in the park for many years. I fished in the park for many years. But today I want to talk about stock trout. And so you've been making some real improvements in the Gatlinburg area, in the fish hatchery up there, the trout hatchery. And one of the things that I wanted to start out with is, what's your process? And how do you make those fish grow so quick? And if you give us a little backstory on the hatchery and that sort of thing, I think that'd get this thing started off on the right foot.
Yeah. So the Gatlinburg Trout Facility was actually started in 1981. The first fish were stocked out of it in 1982. In the history of this facility, over 1 million trout have been stocked out of it into Gatlinburg waters. And we are a somewhat like a partnership with TWRA. Every year in October, TWRA gives me approximately 30,000 fingerling rainbow trout. And in turn, they split the license fees with us and they grant us enforcement powers. So I'm sure you know my history. I was a police officer for 15 years with the city of Gatlinburg. So now I'm a fisheries enforcement special police. So we actually enforce the fishing regulations. It's the only place in the state of Tennessee that anyone besides TWRA has enforcement powers to enforce any fish or wildlife laws. Process has always been pretty much the same. The raceways have looked the same. It's been laid out the same. The main thing that we have done to change it is I've been blessed that the city administrators and commission have given me more money to buy more and better food. If you want bigger fish, you got to give them more food. You talked about the size of the Smokies fish. There's tons of fish in the Smokies, but with an average lifespan of 4 years at an average growth rate of 1 to 2 inches per year, you're looking at most of the time your average rainbow is going to get up to 8 inches. Yes, they get bigger. Some grow faster, some live longer, but that's your average. And you can compare that 1 to 2 inches a year of growth in the park with the capabilities of growing them at 1 inch per month under the right conditions. So obviously being force fed in a clean, protected environment. We have nets over the raceways to protect from the eagles, herons, otters, seen cormorants starting to move in, mink, all kinds of stuff that in the wild are a threat to these fish that we do our best to protect them from here. We do our best to keep the raceways as clean as possible. The cleaner that raceway is, the better it is for the fish. Any waste that we leave in the bottom, the bacteria that decompose that waste actually use up some of the oxygen that the fish need to have. So we've tried to really step up the cleaning efforts and keep all the waste cleaned out of the raceways. The fish food, we previously bought from a local farmers co-op, which is very convenient. They're right down the road. I could call and say, give me some food. And they would have it here. But when it came time to bid the food out, after talking with TWRA about their higher quality food that they were using, we met with the vendor and we now buy directly from the company. So we don't have the middleman markup price. So we're getting a higher quality food at a cheaper price. Plus, I was lucky enough, like I said, for the city to increase my food budget. So we're now buying over twice as much fish food as was supplied in previous years. The fish food that we're getting now is actually pigmented, just like the TWRA fish food. So it's not going to change anything about the fish taste, but it will give the meat a slightly pinker color, but it really makes the colors pop on the fish. You'll start, especially with the colder water, we start getting this time of year and you see those rainbows getting a little brighter, that this pigment is really making for some very pretty fish. Because we're getting more feed, we can feed more food. So the company, BioOregon, that we get the fish food from, they have a recommended chart to go by where you have to sit down with a calculator and say, okay, this raceway has 1,000 pounds of fish in it at 1,000 pounds at this size average fish at this water temperature. Here's how much food you give them. And there's a chart that will, every couple months, we'll revise our chart to put up on the wall in the feed shed so everybody knows how much to feed. And it's based on several different factors like that. And we try to pretty much follow theirs, except for the fact that we, under the prime water temperatures, like 50 to 63 degrees, we actually feed at roughly 120% of their recommended. Trout Lodge is pretty famous for making trout eggs. Did a study using bio-Oregon food, and it was, the study was based on fish that were at ages from their first feeding up to 175 days, so younger than our fish. But they found in those small fish that 120% was where you got optimal growth before you started getting into the negative aspects of increased fish waste and other things. So we're kind of adopting that and experimenting with our raceways and feeding a little bit heavier. And what we're seeing so far is that we're getting a little bit better growth. And if we've got the food to grow them more, we'll grow them. While we're growing the small fish that TWRA gives us. So they just brought me approximately 25,000 fish that are going to average 4 to 7 inches, depending on which raceway they came from. We still have to stock right now. We don't want to stock those. So we buy from a private farm called Novak Trout Farm. He has two different facilities, one based on Stony Creek, just above Elizabethton near Watauga River.
Yeah.
And another one in Chilhowee, Virginia. Because he is on a spring-fed system, he's got good average water temperature year-round, and he gets, I mentioned Trout Lodge earlier, he gets triploid eggs from Trout Lodge, and he grows some really nice fish. So those bigger, more silver-colored fish that we're stocking this time of year will be coming from Novak. But another thing that happened in the past that we have changed is when you would get those fish in, you've bought those fish and they're already big enough to stock, but my idea was, why not make them even bigger? They're already so the 10 pounders you've seen that we stocked, the one that we posted recently on social media, I got that fish last January of 23 at 5 to 6 pounds, and now it was 28 inches 10 pounds when we stocked it in October.
Darn. Okay.
Or so November, I'm sorry.
That is a big
one. So we can get some, if we keep throwing feed at those big fish, we can really get some good growth out of them. Plus, we'll have a better average size in our state fish that we stock.
So back up just a minute. You were talking about the pigment. Is that due so it's a better pigment, a better looking fish? Let's just say that. Because we catch some that are silver, like you were talking about, more silver, more light color. But then you, every once in a while you catch one that's just bright and nice, and it doesn't even have to be bigger. It's just a prettier fish, you know?
Yeah.
So is that due to the, you talk about cold water or your water, is that due to colder water or more oxygen or both, or how does that work?
I think it's both. It seems like every year when we start seeing the water temperatures cool down, you start seeing a little bit better color in the fish. But right now also, even though rainbows don't really spawn until spring, late winter, early spring, they'll go ahead right now and the start building eggs, start changing color for the spawn. So I think it's also got to do with sexual reproduction aspect of it.
Right, right. And I want to get into that a little bit later too, about that sort of thing. So, well, why don't we go ahead and kick this show off from high atop the world headquarters of Southeastern Fly. This is the Southeastern Fly Podcast. Subscribe or follow wherever you listen to the podcast. Remember, we have a new fly fishing podcast group on Facebook, and if you'll just type in Fly Fishing Podcast by Southeastern Fly in your Facebook groups, it'll come up. Look for our blue and silver logo and go ahead and join it, and then we'll take a look, and if you've got a fish picture or some outdoor stuff, we'll generally let you in right away, no problem. So, and if you get a chance or know someone who has not heard the podcast, please go ahead and send them a link to it. Let them listen as well. As long as it's okay if they have the same information you do. If you're trying to hide information from them, by all means, don't send it to them. But so who is our guest today on Southeastern Fly? So I fished with Travis a couple different times. He's a former guide for a mutual friend. He guided for a while for David Knapp at the Trout Zone. And he's guided in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Currently, he's the manager of the Gatlinburg Trout Facility. He's done a lot of work with the fish up there on his side of the world, and I wanted to connect with him and just see what we could learn from him. So please welcome to the podcast, Travis Williams. Travis, thanks for stopping by, man.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I want to, we're going to have to move through this pretty quick because we've got a lot of information. Travis and I spoke earlier, I guess last week, and we kind of walked through his process, which he just walked through a while ago. I like the 120 feeding at 120%. I like the sound of that because that gives us bigger fish. But I don't want to get caught up in this whole stock versus natural. I'm going to go with, you know, we've both fished for both. And most of the people out there have fished for both. Maybe you have a preference. I don't know. I don't really. I love to go up in the Smokies and fish for those little fish. It's more the environment. It's more the experience up there. I also like to come down and fish the tailwaters for stock fish. And some people like to poo-poo the stockers, and I get it. You know, everybody wants to be on one side of an issue or the other. And quite frankly, I don't have the time or energy to argue. I mean, we've got stock trout, wild trout, muskie, smallmouth, largemouth, striper, and a whole host of other fish. I don't want to lose sight of the bluegill and that sort of thing either that we can fish for. But today I want to talk specifically about stock trout on this episode. And one of the questions I get most often while I'm guiding, and I'm in a boat with somebody, you got 6 or 7, 8 hours, sometimes longer. So there's a lot to talk about, and the conversation turns to the fish pretty quickly. I've got some I would say theories of fish and that sort of thing here, but I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but what would you be able to tell us about stock trout reproduction?
That's a tricky one, and it's going to depend on who you ask, what answer you get. So you'll run into fishermen if you're asking them the question. If they're on the Clinch River and they just caught a 3-inch rainbow with par marks, they're saying these fish are reproducing. This is a wild fish. But if you look at the stocking records, a lot of the fish that the TWRA stocks into the Clinch River are fingerling rainbows. When my fingerling rainbows come, you cannot tell visibly the difference between them and a wild Smokies fish. They're gorgeous fish, par marks and everything. So asking the fishermen about it, you're going to get a lot of different answers. Ultimately, as far as tailwaters and that stuff goes, a TWRA biologist is going to be the best answer. So I'm going to mainly stick to the Gatlinburg streams, which I'm pretty familiar with. The issue we have is summer, we get high water temperatures. At this low elevation, we don't have a lot of really good gravel. We had a lot of sediment towards the tails of the pools. We also start, once you hit town here, running into a lot of bedrock areas. So a lot of the tails of these pools are going to have big, slick bedrock that can make wading fairly difficult, but also eliminates good gravel areas. So just the combination of those things mean that once you leave the national park and get into the Gatlinburg waters that I stock, my fish don't have the optimal conditions to reproduce. They are physically, well, the ones I get from the state are physically capable of reproducing. They're not triploid. The big fish that I get from Novak that I mentioned earlier are triploid fish. But for the most part, if my fish were put in the right conditions, they are capable of reproducing. We just don't have the right conditions right here. But for those reasons, Gatlinburg was picked to be a predominantly put and take trout stocked fishery. Typically, areas that are picked to be stocked with trout are areas that won't have any sort of negative impact on the already naturally reproducing populations of trout. So right here, they won't reproduce and they can't physically access the upper regions of this river where we have a lot of southern Appalachian brook trout. Once you get up that high, the conditions are better gravel tails, colder water temperatures, all the things that the fish do need to naturally reproduce. So at that higher elevation, a few miles up the road from us, you will get descendants of stockers, the rainbows, that have established themselves and do naturally reproduce. None of those were already here. They were stocked in the early 1900s and hasn't been stocked since the 70s. So there is a little bit of evidence that at some point stockers will reproduce. But as far as my water here in town, we don't see any very little, if any, natural reproduction. But the fish are, for the most part, physically capable of it.
I've always wondered. So the two things that I've heard is, one is, yeah, they still can do it, but there's not enough gravel And I'm talking about locally here, which is, it sounds like what you're saying. And the other is, well, they heat up the eggs or do something to the eggs. I want to say they heat up and it establishes, or it takes away a chromosome and then they can't reproduce, which is kind of, I guess, the triploids that you were talking about. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I've always heard. Yeah. So,
for the triploids, they pressurize the eggs and the triploid to make them retain an extra third chromosome. Makes them all sterile.
So it adds two, doesn't take away.
They should have two. It adds a third.
Adds to it. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So you're not, you said there's a little bit of reproduction possibly going on. There's just not a lot of gravel up there. It sounds like it's
not a lot of gravel, a lot of sediment.
Yeah.
And then if they did reproduce, the warm water temps that we see in the summer, especially on the spur section, and just be detrimental to the trout. They can survive, but it's not prime conditions.
Right.
And that's part of the reason that our delayed harvest season is shorter than some others. A lot of places like Teleco, they're delayed harvest by October. They've got good water temperatures. Ours can still be a little iffy in October, depending on the weather. So our delayed harvest starts December 1st.
Gotcha.
Ensuring that during catch and release, we can safely release the fish in that water temperature.
Right. But people can take fish out, but not during delayed harvest, correct?
Correct. From April 1st through the end of November, people can keep 5 fish a day, no size limit.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. That's got to be bringing some money to the city to know that you can come up, folks, and go up there and catch some bigger fish and enjoy their vacation and fish a little bit. And you got the park right there. So I think you're sitting in a really good spot up there. And we know that some folks will make their pilgrimage to the Smokies every year. It seems like a lot of my friends from Ohio come down and spend time there. And I've been over there too. I've spent some time in Gatlinburg and I spent some early mornings there eating at the pancake pantry and then going up into the park to fish. That was when I lived over there. That was one of our Saturday morning things. And that was before the pancake pantry. I mean, you could stand in line 10 minutes before it opened and get in there and eat. And I don't know that it's really that way now during the summer, but
we've stand in line for 2 or 3 hours now.
Right. Right. So it's a little different up there now than what it was whenever I was there. And, you know, a lot of people like to go play hillbilly golf, and moonshine tastings is a big thing. For me, one of the things was people watching. I love to sit at Blaine's outside and just watch the people look at all the bad tattoos and that sort of thing that came through there. But not to mention caramel corn and the aquarium. There's just a ton of things to do. But so how would you recommend someone fish for the fish that are in the river at Gatlinburg to make that extra time that you get on the river while you're there? And can you put some information in terms of other stock waters if you can, if you need to bring those in? But what's probably the best way you think to fly fish for the trout up there?
Oh, I'm glad you clarified that. if I stick with the fly fishing, it's an easier explanation. Obviously, spin fishing is a huge draw here, especially during the catch and keep season. We've seen definitely during delayed harvest, but also during the catch and keep season, we've seen a good bit of growth in the number of fly fishermen showing up. Stockers, they're used to me throwing food at them. So when they're fresh, anything brightly colored, egg pattern, San Juan worm, what did they call it? The Obi-Wan Kenosha. It's like a mashup of an egg and worm all in one. Anything ugly, bright to get their attention is going to be the ticket. The problem that I've seen a lot.
That's just after you've stocked them, right?
Yes. That's freshly stocked right out of the truck for a day or two. But these fish get educated quickly. And I'll run into anglers on the stream sometimes who are having a little bit tougher day and they've been throwing the egg, but we're 6 weeks into delayed harvest season. And after so many times of eating a brightly colored egg and getting yanked out of the water thinking it's been abducted by aliens, that fish is going to quit eating the egg. So the smaller natural, I'm old school. I like a pheasant tail. You put a black bead on a size 18 pheasant tail nymph, a little soft hackle, something small and natural that those fish don't feel threatened by. I haven't seen that much of. Plus, they're still going to be seeing small bugs that they're eating all day long. We have a fairly decent insect population in the water, and I'll sit out here at Herbert Holt Park in this kid's area of the evening, and I watched some of these fish sipping blue wing olives and midges in the surface film. So they definitely get smart and start eating stuff in the river quick. So if you fish for them like you would a wild fish, especially after they've been in there for a while, you're going to see your catch rates go up. And I don't know what it is about these triploid fish. They like a streamer. If you fish a Euro rig with a jig streamer, you've got lots of options there with drifting as you jig it, then swing it, strip it back. You can fish it a lot of different ways. Or if you're old school and you want to throw a sink tip line with a 3 or 4 inch streamer on it, they'll eat that. We just have to make sure that if you're throwing articulated streamers, that they are single hook, since we have the single hook rule. For guys that are spin fishing, there was never anything written into the law as far as Gatlinburg and the two flies per liter rule. So in the Smokies, you can have two flies per liter. So what I have adopted is we're enforcing it as a two flies are allowed per liter on a fly rod with a minimum 15 inch distance between the flies. Why is the reason for that? Well, me and everyone else that fly fishes will miss fish. And if those flies are too close together, you could floss it, as I call it, and still wind up hooking it in the mouth with the second fly. But what we see a lot of is they'll hook a pectoral fin or something, and you've got an even longer fight, tiring the fish out worse. And it just reduces the risk of snagging a fish.
Right, right. Don't want them wearing it.
Yeah. Obviously, with the more pressured fish, smaller line, fluorocarbon tippet. Fluorocarbon makes a huge difference, especially when this water gets super just crystal clear like it is right now.
Yeah, y'all haven't had a lot of rain up there either, have you, to speak of?
No. No, we got quite a bit this past weekend. The river went from 2.5 to 7.5 feet. We've dropped back down now. It's finally holding the best level it has since probably July.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. Right. It did that, and then it dropped to 40 degrees. So there's always going to be some variable that makes it a little more difficult. So most of what I mentioned there applies to our delayed harvest. When it's warmer, basically same Smokies bugs. We've got a ton of yellow sallies out here. Okay. So again, pheasant tail is a good imitation for a yellow sally nymph, but you can come out here and pick the water apart with a yellow stimulator and a pheasant tail dropper or whatever your favorite yellow sally pattern is.
Yeah.
When you get into the streamers, recently was fortunate enough to go with Matt Culp and some of the guys from the Smokies to Shock down on the spur and do a sampling. And it's ridiculous how many banded sculpin we have in here. So a good sculpin pattern is a good streamer pattern.
Okay. Oh, so is Minot Park? Minot Park, I'm not sure I'm saying that right. Is that still part of y'all's program up there?
Yes. Minot Park has a kids only area, and Herbert Holt Park, which I'm based out of, has a hopefully opening this week, newly remodeled kids fishing area with an improved access. So where it used to just be shimmy down the riverbank and sit on a rock, now we're going to have a nice 5 foot wide concrete walkway on the river. Mom and dad can set a chair up, watch the kids fish. And there'll also be another walkway approximately 12 feet above that with a handrail. So you could sit up there and watch with a good view of the river if you wanted to.
So a couple things. One is everybody thinks that all the big fish are in the kids areas, and that's just simply not true.
No.
I don't know how many people I've said, I can't fish the kids area. I'm like, dude, don't worry about it. Just there are big fish everywhere. But
yeah.
Minot Park, whenever I took my daughter fishing up there, she might have been on the boat once or twice, but we went to Minot Park. We were staying up in the art section or whatever it's called up there, above the food line. And I took her fishing one day. We stopped by the local fly shop there, and they said, just go to Minot Park. You know, I want to know where can I take this big girl here? She's ready to catch a fish. Well, we went up to Minot Park, and it was interesting. I was looking in the water, and she said, Dad, what's that right there? Is that not a fish? She spotted this really nice fish. And it's before I had a cell phone, so that's kind of telling on myself. But she said, is that a fish? And I said, yeah, yeah. She said, well, I don't know. I just said it was a nice fish, too. It was obviously one of the better stalkers at the time. So I put on one of the flies that I designed, and she threw it in there and caught that fish. The only problem with that whole thing was, I was probably more excited you know, and she was like, okay, can we go back home now? But I was, you know how that goes whenever they're that young. But I had a camera that had film in it, if that tells you anything. And I had it in my pocket, and you know how hot and muggy and damp it is up there. Whenever I pulled it out, I snapped a picture of that thing. And whenever I went and had it developed, it was all it was just blur. Like it had so much condensation on it that it didn't even get a good picture of it. And I was like, dang gummit. So anyway, it's a long way. I don't want to get too far in the back end on that one, but there's just a bunch of water up there that has different opportunities. So kids' water, your delayed harvest gives a different opportunity. During the year gives a different opportunity. I've always wanted to and haven't yet, but I'm going to is fish right through the middle of town as much as I can. You know, if I don't want to get in anybody's way, but I've always wanted to do that. And I pulled that from a friend of mine. He had always wanted to do that, but there are a lot of opportunities up there. And I know you've been working hard to improve the quality of the fish and the fisheries, but help us understand some of the upcoming improvements that you're implementing up there.
Upcoming improvements. I just touched on the Herbert Holt improved access down here. So Herbert Holt Park is for kids 12 and under only. We've got approximately 90 feet of concrete walkway on the river now to improve the access there. And it's also home to one of the few freestone stream handicap accessible areas. So we have the Bill Stevens handicap ramp here at the park. They recently constructed a ramp at the Teleco near their hatchery, but there's not a lot of places that allow handicapped individuals access to a freestone trout stream. That is the only place in Herbert Holt Park that adults are allowed to fish. Handicapped people of any age can use the handicapped accessible pier. If we see parents helping the kid, as long as the kid's reeling the fish in, now if you've got an infant sitting in a stroller that can't hold a rod on its own, dad is just fishing. We look at that a little differently. We try to allow a little bit there for the parents. I've got three kids myself. I know it can be difficult to get them catching fish. We've talked to a couple other businesses downtown about possibly using our walkways that we put in here as a model to help improve access overall downtown. The Park Service has actually talked to us. They're looking at doing some improvement along the spur as part of their safety project and adding around 4, I believe, more legal paved parking areas and improving the river access at those. So that would be a huge help for us because that area, which you mentioned our water earlier and what we have, a lot of people don't understand that the spur, for the most part, is Gatlinburg water. It's the Foothills Parkway right-of-way, that 5-mile stretch between Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge. So the Park Service owns it, but they've granted the water rights to the state of Tennessee, who grant those water rights to us to manage it with the trout stocking. So where Natty Branch runs into the river, just below the Natty Branch and King Branch Bridge, is actually our lower boundary. So
okay, all right.
Them making safety improvements down there will also help to improve our access. And there's a few other things I want to look at, like maybe putting some more sets of steps at some of the bridges just to make it easier access. Being such a highly visited tourist area, unfortunately, not everyone's trash makes it to the trash receptacle. So we've started every spring having a spring season opener the first Saturday in April, which we've made a fishing tournament coupled with a river cleanup. There are prizes for people bringing back big fish, obviously, but we also have prize categories for whoever brings back the most litter. And if you wish to be eligible for the fishing prizes, you have to bring me at least a grocery bag full of litter from the stream side. So we've had a truckload of wooden pallets, a toilet, all kinds of crazy stuff pulled from the river and brought in the last 2 years for having this tournament.
Oh, huh, okay.
That's our riverbank and stream issues. Facilities improvements. We're looking at, it's going to change our stocking for the next year, but if something doesn't happen around mid-April, we're going to completely empty the trout facility and rebuild it. I mentioned earlier it was built in 1981, so it's obviously due for some upgrades. We're going to put all new plumbing, new concrete, put a pavilion-style roof over it, put the chain-link fence around it. So now instead of having nets that I have to remove every day to clean, I can just walk in, clean. Greatly reduces the risk of predators. Makes it a much safer working environment for us and allows me to keep it cleaner, which will help me to grow bigger fish. It also, even though the overall dimensions won't change, the water will get a little bit deeper. And by the time we figure all that extra volume, we will have almost one extra raceway's worth of carrying capacity.
Nice. Okay.
With that, we're adding a set of bleachers and going to start trying to work with the local school systems to hold field trips. Where you started opening to the public already to do tours when people come in, but this will give a much better environment for doing that. And actually went to, was very lucky to get to go to it because it's just for elementary school teachers, but went to a water ecology school in Maine this past summer, which certified me to teach a basic stream ecology course, which we hope to develop a curriculum for to start helping out the hosting the field trips. Increasing the enforcement. I mentioned earlier that we have the power here to increase or to enforce the fishing regulations, and we're not looking to go out there, write tickets and hammer people. It's more about getting out there, talking to people, give advice if they're not catching, get these kids catching some fish, and just having good community contacts. Just the fact that they know we're out there checking is a good deterrent to keep people from fishing illegally, but we view it more as just getting out there and having good contacts with the community and the fishermen.
That's a big thing. The rivers that I fish, I probably get checked more than anybody, I would say, or as much as anybody else, I'll put it that way. But you don't hear much about it when I, whenever I run into TWRA on our rivers, they you know, how's the fishing going? Are you catching anything? And I'll ask them, the more important thing is, are you catching anything? You know, are you catching anybody? And then sometimes they are. I've sat on the riverbank cooking lunch one day, and this is many years ago, and they pulled over right where we were eating, and they were like, hey, y'all mind if we stand right down here? And I said, no, but I mean, I don't have enough food for you to eat, but, you know, you're welcome to stand down there. And they just checked people in kayaks and canoes as they came by. They only wrote one ticket in about an hour. But it was a guy I think they wrote two, one without a fishing license and one without a life preserver. And, I got a front row seat to how people react to seeing a law, an enforcement person out there. And it's fun to sit and watch. And I know that you did police work and that sort of thing, but it's fun, fun to sit and watch this type, because it's not like life or death in this particular situation. To the reactions of people whenever they get it. Can I see your license? Where's your life preserver, flotation device? And, oh, it's in their kayak. Well, you might ought to put it in yours. And, you know, and the guy that got the biggest ticket, I can't remember how much it was. Now it felt like it was $200 or something like that, but it may not have been that. Was he, the enforcement officer, TWRA, said, can I see your life jacket? And the guy completely turned his head, like they were standing on the bank, and he was just, you know, they were just yelling to him, well, talking to him, and, you know, completely turned his head. And then he rode a little bit more, and he said, sir, can I see your life preserver? And I'm looking in this kayak thinking, well, if he's not dragging it along the bottom, he ain't got one. And so finally the guy turned around, and he said, pull over to the side. And he said, I didn't think you needed a life jacket if you were in a boat. That was his answer. I'm like, dude, you're busted. Just, you know, come clean. And if you would have come to the side, they had extra life jackets in their boat, the TWRA did. And they probably would have just given it to him and said, you know, take it up to the store up there and whenever you get done and just leave it there. We'll stop by and pick it up for the next trip. But no, he was not forthcoming, let's put it that way.
So that seems to be the way it goes. Usually the ones that wind up getting a ticket are the ones that just completely resist being checked at all. And I think I may have written 9 tickets in the little over 2 years I've been down here.
Yeah.
But I've had way more people say, hey, I'm glad you're out checking. I'm glad to see somebody out checking. Yeah, and not to knock TWRA, they don't get to check people as much as they would like to. They've got so much going on. Like, we have a local delayed harvest stream that I've had people say, why are they not up there? Well, they've got this one small section full of trout that they have to try to patrol right in the middle of deer season, bear season, all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Short on manpower, spread thin. So it'd be nice if everyone, if they had a smaller area to patrol as I do, I'm sure we would cut down on poaching statewide, but they're spread so thin. They do all they can, and they're a huge help to me.
Yeah, well, good. I, I'm glad y'all have a good working relationship, and I would like to see that more between all the agencies to make, you know, obviously I want bigger fish and more fish, you know, and that sort of thing. And so I've got a, you know, I've got a kind of a different view than maybe somebody that's outside of fishing, but that's my main thing is I want to, not only do I want to guide people and have them catch fish, but I also want to hear about people catching fish and, you know, having that big gripping grin. We all have them, and they don't have to be the biggest fish in the river, but it'd be nice if we could catch the biggest fish in the river. But
that's right.
So what do you think some of the challenges are of running a hatchery like you're doing?
Oh man, the weather is the biggest thing. It's something all the time. Just when you get the last problem figured out, the season's changed and you're on to the next one. So I this past Saturday and the Saturday before, I spent half the night down here. It never happens during your shift while you're at work. It's on a weekend, middle of the night. You get rain, the water shoots up 5 feet, and every leaf between here and Clingman's Dome comes down the river. The lowest valley is always the stream. So most leaves are going to blow till they hit that low spot, and they'll lay there. And when the stream comes up, they come with it, and they'll stop up my intake. So we have an automatic cleaning system. That's a huge air compressor. A little bit too difficult to explain without showing it to you in person, but it helps me a lot. Where the people at Teleco run a gravity feed system, they stand in the river with a brush in the fall, and they'll change shifts standing waist deep with a push broom sweeping leaves off their intake. And I'm lucky enough to have a little higher tech system that does some of that for me. But at some point, you do have to come in and deal with the leaves. Then it turns cold and you start dealing with ice. Last Christmas, I'm sure you all had the same thing, was really deep freeze. This river froze completely from one side to the other, people walking on it. So my water intake in the river was about to freeze. We tried everything in the world, tying a sledgehammer to a rope and throwing it out to break the ice. But ultimately, you had to put the waders on while it was 17 degrees outside, get in the river and manually break 2-inch sheets of ice and shove them down the river. Springtime is when we typically see the most rain and the most flash flooding. So we deal with a lot of sand, silt, sediment stuff that comes down the river. Have to clean out our wet well occasionally, and it will sometimes, like July 20th this past year, it dumped over a dump truck full of sand into the raceways that we have to manually remove. And then summer, we start looking at high water temps. Typically mid-July through September, we struggle with water temperatures. But seasonal challenges are, we just roll from one to the next, and that seems to be the most trouble. The predators are a little bit of trouble. If I've not sealed the gravel back up and left a gap under the fence, an otter will get in. If I forget to put a net back on the raceway, the great blue heron will peck at them. But they're not nearly as big an issue as the weather challenges are.
Oh. So in the summer, you said the water heats up and all that. What does that do to the dissolved oxygen? Do y'all monitor that as well, or do you have to?
We had a dissolved oxygen meter that recently quit working, but it definitely depletes it. The warmer the water is, the less it's going to hold on to that oxygen. Even if we put a system in here to put concentrated oxygen in it, the water's just not going to hold it long enough to make a huge difference. So cost effectiveness, the best thing that we have found is this past year we bought 6 surface aerators. It's a 3/4 horsepower motor that just churns the water up like a little 2-foot high fountain. And then each raceway is probably getting around, around 400 gallons per minute dumped into it. And these things are capable of circulating 800 gallons per minute. So they really churn that water up. Right now they're about midway down each raceway. And we definitely saw an improvement this year versus last summer, having those surface aerators in place.
Nice. Nice. Very nice. You've been doing a ton of work up there, and I've been hearing things here and there about Gatlinburg and the hatchery and the fish, mostly the fish, of course. So word's getting out that you're doing something right. And it sounds like it's more than just one thing. At first I was like, well, makes sense that he's feeding the fish more and they're growing, but it's more than that. And I keep thinking back as we're talking about the clean raceways.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but that just is, it almost just makes sense. You know, it's almost like, oh, well, that's common sense. You know, the cleaner, the better. I like to eat off a clean plate. They like to eat off a clean plate, you know? But so it's not just I'm doing one big thing. It's we are doing a whole bunch of little things to make this thing better, which yes. Maybe that's going to be the, maybe that'll be the vision for the future for a lot of hatcheries that are, you know, want to grow fish. Or I think it comes back to whoever's running it really has to want to get in there and really work hard and put all that other stuff out of their mind. All the negatives, put it out of your mind. Like anything else, if you want to focus on something, I think that's the big thing is if I focus on it and I try to put all the negatives out of my mind, because I'm sure you have negatives too, just like guiding, just like anything we do, you can, yeah. You can harp on those negatives and really, really shoot yourself in the foot, or you can,
yeah.
You know, work with them and try to control what you can and then work on the things that you think are important that will make a positive impact. So, you know, if I was smoking a cigar, I'd give you one and say, good job up there so far. So, so as we bring this episode to a close, Travis, I just want to say, we ask this of everybody, and there's no right or wrong answer, but what's the one question we didn't ask about growing fish and stockfish tendencies that we didn't ask?
Well, as you know, as a fisherman, it's never our fault when we have a day that we didn't catch a fish.
Amen to that.
The barometric pressure, the cold front coming in, somebody kept them all, or what I've been getting a whole lot recently is they all washed away. And people asking, do the fish wash away when the water gets high and it floods? The overall easy answer is no. These little torpedoes are designed to live in fast water. They're shaped right. They know how to act. Water comes up, you know, you fish the slow edge because that's where the fish move. Any obstruction in the water that can slow that current, rock wall, rock, log, they can tuck behind that and hide in a little eddy. Most of the time, the surface speed of the water is going to get a whole lot faster, but if the fish goes down deep, it's not going to be that much faster. Not always, but typically the surface is faster. That's why if you get those nymphs down in there, let them drift along the slow bottom current, you catch more fish. These fish will hide in those areas. Now, they will become disoriented and turn and move. They will be a little bit more spread out, but they're not, it's not like we're going to get a rain and all of my trout are in the French Broad River now in Sevierville. They move around a little bit, but for the most part, when you go back, the fish are still going to be in those holes. Any time of year, high water or not, there's going to be the occasional fish that I put in the river that turns and he's headed for the lake, wide open downstream. And you'll see people, I recently saw a picture near the Sevier County Jail Annex down by the fairgrounds on the Little Pigeon River. Somebody caught a 4-pound rainbow trout. That could have been one of mine or it could have been one from Pigeon Forge, but there will be the random fish that turns and runs. But for the most part, the fish don't wash away. They're designed for these environments and they'll hold in pretty well.
Huh. I've always wondered where they go. I mean, I know they go deep and behind the logs and stuff like that, but I just figure they sit there and try not to drown until the water gets at a reasonable pace and then they come back out.
Yeah. For the most part, it's those slow edges. I got a buddy, Mark, that we don't get to fish as much as we should anymore. Both got stuff going on, but he was in the Elkmont one day fishing. River shot up where he was fishing the campground. And when I say fishing the campground, I mean, he was standing where the water wasn't supposed to be by a picnic table, still yep. catching fish because they pushed to that slow edge.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. You can still get, I've been up there whenever the water comes up fast and it's, all I could think about was get out as quick as you yeah. can.
It's scary.
It is scary. And you don't, I had heard that. I had heard that and heard that and heard that. And I thought, yeah, it probably is a little scary, but let yeah. me tell you, it's really scary whenever you're in it and it's happening. You, all you can think about is get to high ground because something's yeah. happening upstream. And, you know, there's no dam up there. So the dam didn't break, but it's just a big rainstorm up there. So, yeah. So they do just run to where we think they run. And it probably takes them a day or two to start eating again. Like, you know, like any event that we have in our lives, food may not be the first thing on the menu once to get as you're getting things straight, but after that, they should start eating again. So
yeah,
they have to eat. That's another thing I say all the time is if they're not eating right now, they're sooner or later, they have to eat. I mean, they can't go without food. So
yeah.
Travis, what do you say we close this show out?
It sounds good to me. I got to get out here and feed these fish their lunch.
All right. Share the podcast with your friends and your fishing partners. Subscribe or follow so you'll be the first to know when an episode drops. And if you can, give us a positive rating on wherever you're listening to your podcasts or consume podcasts. That actually helps us out a little bit in some ways. And I want to go ahead and answer the question of who was our guest on this episode of Southeastern Fly. He's a former guide at Trout Zone Anglers. He guided in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. He's the manager at the Gatlinburg Trout Facility. And as you just heard, he's doing a ton of work up there to make improvements in the fishing, but not only that, other improvements within the facility and the banks and that sort of thing. He is Travis Williams. Travis, thanks for stopping by, man.
No, thanks for having me.
You just listened to Travis Williams in Fishing for Stock Trout in Gatlinburg on Southeastern Fly. See you next time.